Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today we have Claire Cherry with us. Claire is an investment principal at True Global, a retail and consumer sector specialist investment firm investing in disruptive tech products and teams. I've known Claire for quite some time, a couple of years, I think now. It's really wonderful to have you here with me on the pod, finally.
Great to be here. Yeah, very much looking forward to it.
Amazing. So let's dive right in. You've been working in finance pretty much since you graduated. What drew you to the industry and kind of what sparked your interest in working with early stage ventures in particular? Because that's really where the focus is for you, because True has both the VC and the PE sort of side of things.
Yeah, I think if I'm totally honest, I certainly fell into venture. I'm actually a scientist by background, really realized that plugging away in a laboratory for the rest of my life probably wasn't necessarily going to tick all of my boxes. So actually took just a 6-week placement at an early stage investment fund based in London. And here we are almost 10 years later. I guess the most interesting thing for me is probably what kept me in the industry. And it is that diversity, both of businesses, of people. You know, you meet some, as you will know from doing this and more broadly, you meet some fantastic characters. And I think every day is completely different from the last. So yeah, for me, that's been the real draw. And I guess I have seen both sides of the equation from a funding landscape. So I did a brief stint actually at a private equity fund, which was investing, you know, bigger investment sizes, probably rounds of 10 to 50 million. But for me, I just kept coming back to the dynamism of early stage investing. You know, you never know what's going to be round the corner from your portfolio, from new opportunities. And that's super exciting to me. So yeah, it's been a great journey so far.
Just to pull on a thread there, right? But one of the things I say quite often is that stage investing is more art than it is science, especially at pre-seed and seed level. So how have you kind of drawn on your skills as a scientist to inform kind of how you think about investing? Like yesterday, one of our guests was talking about potential to kinetic kind of energy and transformation, like, and that's the way that they've sort of brought their scientific learnings into the investment world. But how have you bridged that kind of, I guess, quite large gap?
Yeah, for sure. I think from my perspective, you know, really at True, particularly, we invest in two types of businesses. So sort of pre-launch, pre-seed, pre-revenue. Certainly that's probably more akin to what we did in the science lab, where ultimately everything at that point is a hypothesis. It's a hypothesis about how you build out your technology, your customer base, you know. Really, I actually did a virtual MBA, and the biggest piece that stuck with me is that, you know, goal setting, particularly for teams and early stage businesses, can be really challenging, because if you don't hit those goals, it feels like a failure. Whereas if you set it as a hypothesis, you can never be wrong. You just iterate and you go forward from that. And I think I've taken that with me, I guess, particularly across some of the really early businesses that we invest in, where, you know, they could be 2, 3, 4 years from commercial launch or generating revenue. And that skill set and that evaluation is very different to ones where you can hang your hat on monthly trading or weekly trading or projections. And then I guess to that end, on the other side of the investment spectrum, you know, certainly it's ultimately just analysis and kind of an ability to assimilate information 9 times out of 10. And a big part of what we do, and I know that other guests have touched on it before, is ultimately the most challenging thing is the sifting piece between, you know, receiving 3,000 business plans a year and deciding which 100 to take meetings with, and ultimately when that distills down to the 5 investments. So a big part of that is just an ability to understand and take trends and see opportunities in the data. So as much as it is for me a big people business, you know, there is an element of that, I guess, that harps back to my background and what I grew up with.
Yeah, I think when you frame it in that way of test and iterate, then yes, it obviously clicks very quickly that it is that kind of scientific process of exploration as opposed to rigid rules. And I guess I was coming at it maybe from the thought process of, well, you know, is there a Newtonian law that governs early stage venture investing? But maybe that's exactly the wrong way to look at it. Interestingly, True is a retail and consumer focused fund, right? But today, that's basically everything. That could cover quite a broad range of verticals. Can you give us a bit of an idea of the sort of startups that you like to back?
Yeah, of course. And you're entirely correct that, yeah, consumer broadly touches everything these days, particularly with the advent of, you know, social commerce and all of the good stuff that's come around, the rise of the internet and moving into Web 3.0 and beyond. But for us, I guess there's probably two core areas which we hang our hats on. The first is a real focus around disruptive consumer brands. So businesses physically shipping products to people. And part of that is for us all about the people, both the internal teams, but the external customer base. So we really dive into specific niches where we believe there's an opportunity for people to build almost evangelical communities. So, you know, businesses that are defined by amazing word of mouth referrals. They're not dependent on Facebook for paid marketing. They don't just line the pockets of Google and all of that good stuff, which I think, you know, the venture space particularly has probably gone around the houses on that front. I think certainly historically there was a focus on that. Then we went to kind of growth at all costs, plug it through Facebook, fantastic CACs, exponential growth. And now we're coming into the next wave from that perspective. So we've done anything from sexual wellness through to fashion through to homewares. You know, we don't necessarily specialize in any one kind of sub vertical within consumer, but really putting customer first and that community centric piece is super important. And then the other side is more of the B2B technologies and enabling those consumer brands and retailers to accelerate their growth. So I guess anything from, we invested in Spirable, which is a personalized video marketing tool, all the way through to Habu, which is a fulfillment platform for micro SMEs. And really for us, it's about creating that ecosystem of introducing brands to B2B technology businesses and vice versa to accelerate the growth of them both. So we've seen, yeah, great results in that so far and really see that as, I guess, a core thesis for us going forward.
Yeah, so it's not just about the businesses shipping products to consumers. It's the kind of picks and shovels that go behind it. The infrastructure, Habu that you mentioned, I think works as kind of that infrastructure layer of delivery for other businesses, if I'm not mistaken. And True has this sort of dual VC and private equity fund structure. When I say dual, I mean, there are separate funds, clearly. But what's the linkage between the VC fund and the PE fund? And does that influence, or how does that influence decisions you make around investments? I mean, is it very much the case that you look at investments that can graduate into the PE fund, or do you just look at them as completely separate investment vehicles?
Yeah, so I guess just to give a bit of background on that. So we have two separate investment funds, one that invests up to 5 million, so broadly pre-seed to Series A, the other that invests 20 to 60 million into scale-up brands. I would say they are managed by separate teams. Obviously, you know, there is a lot of crossover in terms of the areas and the expertise in where we're looking, but ultimately the businesses do take different trajectories. So if we take some of our venture investments, you know, like the Habus of the world, realistically, they will raise a sizable seed round, go on to raise an even bigger Series A, and on that funding journey, I guess, typically towards IPO these days, given where the markets are. But our private equity funds really focus, I guess, on more steady, you know, year-on-year growth, profitability. So it's not to say that a brand or a technology platform couldn't migrate from one to the other, but I do think they are sort of very different risk profiles and very different appetites. However, the private equity fund gives us, you know, again, a whole bank of knowledge about sectors, what margins might look like at scale, what we can expect from a business profile, the shape of teams. You know, if we're thinking about, for instance, building out e-commerce teams, generally we would reference with our private equity fund to say, what does good look like and what shapes have worked within that. So a big part of venture, you know, is ultimately the people side and the team building. So we certainly draw on that quite heavily from our private equity fund, and equally access to those individuals, access to people that have run businesses generating, you know, 100 to 200 million of sales, and all of that piece that is ultimately coming down the track for a lot of our portfolio companies. So although I guess the investment entry point is very separate, you know, we do mine that network, particularly for the venture side.
I think that's super interesting. And I think it's something that some of our audience and listeners may not really have a massive understanding of. Many will, for sure. So obviously the difference between venture capital and private equity, as you just alluded to, is private equity tends to come in at much later stage, lower risk profile. They're typically profitable businesses, much larger scale, often asset, and certainly private equity has been moving into software businesses, whereas venture obviously is at those much earlier stages. So apart from that knowledge transfer piece, there's also presumably it serves as almost like a hunting ground for potential customers for the earlier stage businesses, where they can test out maybe products or services on those more established players who have ability to take, you know, take those more, you know, those younger businesses and products and maybe, you know, give them a try. Whereas if you're constantly just trying to sell to less established businesses, there's always that risk that they don't have the cash or the ability or even, you know, the bandwidth to look at them. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, entirely. And I guess from our perspective, we do have another arm to our business, because obviously two isn't enough, and you need three legs to make a stool. And that's a kind of innovation consultancy. So we work with some of the large retailers here in the UK, like John Lewis and Marks and Spencer's, all the way through to Shell and 7-Eleven in the US. And again, we facilitate exactly that. So it's sort of a test bed for both portfolio and non-portfolio companies to really test and iterate and run efficient pilots. And it gives them kind of buy-in at that senior level. And particularly aside from Habu, which would actually be our main business serving SMEs, most of them are trying to get into enterprise clients. So providing that base of private equity businesses and partners that we have on the innovation side really means that they can get up that curve much quicker. And I think with much more open and honest feedback loops, you know, the biggest challenge to growth for a lot of startups, whether it is B2B or D2C, is ultimately getting that iterative process running and working, whether it be product development, tech build, marketing, you know, all of those pieces feed into it. So the quicker we can facilitate that, certainly we have seen some shortening of those growth curves for sure.
Yeah. And I guess with those more established businesses or very established businesses, like you mentioned, that are acting as sort of feeding points for that innovation hub, they are also desperately looking for that next disruptive technology or business that is coming, either nipping at their heels or that they can absorb effectively to grow their own businesses. So I think, you know, we're seeing more and more of that. We obviously have a number of accelerators out there that have, you know, a model of, and it clearly is something that I think are more attuned to the fact that they need these younger businesses to, you know, to fuel their growth down the track. So coming to kind of what it is that you look for. So obviously the sector is really important, and I think pre-seed and seed is really your main hunting ground. But what does a venture have to have for you to consider investing beyond that vertical? Like, what is it that really has to be there? Is it the team, the traction, is it the tech, is it the market, is it a combination of all of those things? Or is it, you know, that's something that can't be described at all, and it's just a sense you get when you're talking to the founders? You know, you talked about 3,000 business proposals down to 100 meetings down to maybe 10 investments. I don't even know if it's as much as 10, actually, as many as 10. Yeah, what are you looking for? What's that spark that gets your interest?
Yeah, I would say certainly a big chunk of it is what you feel in that initial meeting. You know, I would say obviously over the last year, that's gone from in-person to virtual to a hybrid. But really, a lot of it still, even at kind of the late seed Series A stages, the team, their ability to both raise money, frankly, to come up with a clear vision of where they want to take the business, to assemble an amazing team around them, and equally to drive that business forward. You know, typically kind of founder market fit is one of the most challenging pieces, and ensuring that we're aligned on ambitions. You know, ultimately, there are very successful funding rounds that we won't participate in, because ultimately, you know, perhaps our vision is slightly different for the business to the founders or other investors, and every fund will have kind of a unique perspective on that, but that's certainly very important. And then, of course, you know, traction for us is a hybrid of both financial and non-financial KPIs. I think we've become much more rigorous around the non-financial side. So again, some of those softer pieces around, can you build a community? Can you build people that are going to rave about your products to their gran, their parents, you know, whoever they come into contact with on the street? And that can be both. I think the most interesting thing is that it's B2B as much as it is D2C these days. You know, it's not enough just to build an enterprise sales force. They have to be passionate and knowledgeable and, you know, as educated as the founder on the proposition. And then I guess the other piece that probably comes into play for us now is a big focus around sustainability. Obviously, we've avoided any businesses where we might get into greenwashing, and it's, you know, a real treacherous market from a consumer perspective around sustainability at the moment, and slightly odd dynamics in that on the one hand, you have the TikTok and the Snapchat and Gen Z of the world who are raving about sustainability and COP26 and boycotting all of these things. But when it comes to purchase, they still want it to be delivered next day at an equivalent price, an equivalent quality and sustainable. So yeah, it's quite a minefield from that perspective. But, you know, we've done anything from the Shell Works, which is a sustainable, fully biodegradable alternative to plastic packaging, all the way through to the world's first flushable and plastic-free sanitary pad. So yeah, seeing some really exciting pieces on that side as well. But I would say for some swathes of consumer, that's a big reason why we turn off, is that we're really looking for that next generation from a, you know, environmental and ethical perspective.
I find that really interesting. And the reason I find that interesting is that so much of tech is around how to get people to consume more. And therefore, how do you balance that with that kind of sustainability piece? And, you know, to your point, not just consume more, but consume it more quickly. You know, so we have obviously the rise of 15-minute delivery apps and, you know, businesses that are more on demand, more in-home, more at home, more now. In fact, I think there's a great Netflix comedy which explores that, a stand-up bit. I'll have to dig it out. But what is the balance then to strike between sustainability and ethical or sort of stakeholder goals versus really the ambitions of any venture fund, which is, let's face it, to return capital back to LPs and, you know, and to return the fund? Because often those things can be at odds, because whilst you're trying to create something that is sustainable, you may have to sacrifice shareholder returns, or vice versa. If you want to maximize shareholder returns, you may have to look at those stakeholder returns in a slightly different way. Do you find that it's a trade-off, or do you often find that actually founders are able to navigate both of those paths quite easily?
I think certainly you're right in that it can be a trade-off. You know, for us, I guess when we raised our third investment fund, which will close about 50 million, we intentionally kept that fund small so that we don't have to run investments for $1 billion exit every single time. Because I think as soon as you do single in on that as a, I guess, an overarching goal, which a number of funds do, particularly in the US and more here, you know, it is ultimately you have to get to hundreds of millions. And the easiest way to get that is to go mass market, cheaper, higher margins, you know, all of that piece that ultimately leads you down that path where sustainability is challenging. And, you know, we have seen from a B2B and technology perspective, you know, we looked at businesses 5-6 years ago that were running blockchain backed transparency and sustainability pieces so that you could track your supply chain. But there was no adoption because it wasn't high enough up on the agenda of all the businesses they were selling into. So it certainly is still a dichotomy in the market. I think for us, there's probably two ways that it plays out. The first is that, you know, we now are probably investing in some businesses that have been around longer than we would otherwise have done, that have that true sustainable focus. So I'd say most of them are kind of 5 to 10 years into the journey, realistically, by the time they come across our desk. And, you know, that has been a reframing internally to say, it doesn't mean they're any less successful that they haven't got to 100 million in 5 years if they've been building out their own supply chain or their own manufacturing plants, because 9 times out of 10, that's what it comes down to for consumer brands, is truly owning that end-to-end piece. And I think ultimately over time, that makes them exponentially more defensible. I guess the counter argument is, particularly in consumer, is there any defensibility other than a brand or a good founder story? You know, that's the other piece that kind of often gets raised. And equally, going down the sustainability route gives you another bow to your arrow outside of just building a brand. But yeah, I think the tech piece is more interesting. It feels like that's certainly, you know, probably 3, 4, 5 years behind where kind of our brands are thinking about it, because there isn't that push from the customer base. And ultimately, that is what drives most of these businesses, I guess, towards more sustainable ways of working. So how that plays out, yeah, will be one to watch for sure over the coming years.
Brands is super interesting, because you're right, it's not just consumer now, it is B2B. We think about brands like Monday.com, you know, Xero. These are businesses that are now starting to make so many sort of different types of industries and users. Or maybe it's just me and my sad little echo chamber that everyone I speak to seems to know what Xero is. That is quite feasible. And I think it is getting harder and harder to stand out, because everyone now has the ability to really push that brand creation another level. It's sort of like what you talked about earlier, whereby previously your fastest way to growth was via Facebook, Google ads, all of which is now changing, certainly in Europe, and we're going to see changes, I think, coming through. And of course, over more recent times has moved towards more creator style, you know, content driven expansion. So maybe more organic, maybe more defensible, maybe more natural, I think. But to your point, slower and, you know, not as quick in terms of growth. And I think maybe that's what's going to differentiate some of the brands of today versus the brands in the last 10 years. You know, they've gone out and created value that their customers and their clients really buy into. And those are the brands that they want to look at. And you and I talked about earlier, just, you know, the current sort of state of play within venture generally. It's a really, really crazy time, and deals are getting done quicker than ever. And, you know, investors are getting pushed out of really hot deals. So you've been in the early stage ecosystem for sort of the last 5, 6 years. What has changed, and what do you think is changing and will change for the future?
Yeah, I think the biggest move is the one that you've just mentioned, and that ultimately it's a founder dictated market at the moment. You know, it is not investors dictating what gets funded. I can't put my hand on my heart and say anything recently that we've seen that we've passed hasn't been funded, because there's so much capital awash and trying to find a home. That means, yeah, it's hyper competitive for us. Valuations are sky high. You know, it's all of the challenges certainly that really feel like they're coming to a head over the last 6 months or so. And I think from my perspective, there will be a reset at some point. You know, we've been funding a lot of things on convertible notes. It basically means founders and investors can't agree on a price. So how that all washes out, I think, will be driven by the US. Ultimately, it's their creation of a kind of safe coming out of Y Combinator anyway. And I think that is likely to push some challenges through in the market. And particularly, you know, most things are being priced off of 1 year forward, 2 year forward, a run rate that, you know, maybe is not necessarily recurring revenue in the way that you or I would think about recurring revenue. So I think that for me, the next 12 months is probably going to be challenging, but equally, I see no signs of that abating as we sit here today. And, you know, if you'd asked me even a year ago, I probably would have said the same thing then. So yeah, maybe don't quote me on my timings, but it is certainly the biggest change is just the dynamic around raising capital quicker, less work. You know, we have really restructured ourselves as a fund, frankly, to ultimately write much smaller initial investments and then follow on with a lot more, because if we want to be in, we're not doing any work up front. There's no ability to do that. So you kind of have to balance the risk from a portfolio perspective. And again, you know, given that we finished deploying our second fund only earlier this year, it's sort of too early to say how that all plays out. But certainly from our portfolio perspective, you know, we typically modeled that these businesses were going to be hitting Series A, Series B's probably 2.5 years after we initially invested. I'd say now is anywhere from 6 to 12 months. So, you know, I guess that gives you an indication that it's kind of across the market at all areas of venture. So yeah, it's fantastic for those that pull it off. But I do think it's a real creation of the winners and the losers. You know, if you can't get a fund on the cap table to come in 2 weeks, then it's a real bad signal and you're probably not going to raise that round. And I think that's certainly a balance that we have to manage with our portfolios, to say you only go out once you know there's 100% certainty that it's going to get done, because, you know, otherwise it is a bit of a black mark and it is a very small space in particularly the UK venture market that, you know, you can't afford to do that probably more than once or twice. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure on founders around the fundraising piece, as much as they also hold the cards on price.
Yeah, they're caught between a rock and a hard place at the moment, because never has there been so much capital, but never has it been harder to actually close the deal unless you are a deal that people want to close. I would have thought about crowdfunding in the past, right? So a lot of businesses that couldn't necessarily get venture backed. But now, as you say, if you're not able to raise in this market, then, you know, maybe you need to go back to your plan and have a look again. One thing I've definitely found, getting really anxious to get into deals, and some of them are getting excluded, and that causes sort of, you know, it's one of those moments I think founders are sort of celebrating the moment where they now hold some of that power. But I think, you know, what goes around comes around at the end of the day. I think you want to look for the investors that are right for your business always, irrespective. So it's not just about the money. You want to find, you know, the investors that are going to actually support and help you grow and help you raise that next round and go beyond, you know, today. And I think those dynamics, it's very easy to sort of look at that kind of power shift and try and take advantage of it. I always kind of, you know, talk to the businesses that I work with and say, look, you know, the market is what it is today. It'll change again tomorrow, it'll change the day after that. So, you know, you got to play the long game, not the short game.
I was just going to say one final point on that is I completely agree that, you know, I think the move actually in crowdfunding has been really interesting, in that, you know, as you said, I guess typically it would have been kind of a route of last resort when I probably started at True 5 years ago. Whereas now actually we're seeing again, you know, people are sat on multiple trillions worth of savings and they really want to back their favorite brands. So a lot of our businesses get requests from customers about wanting to join crowdfunding rounds, or when are they going to be raising? And I think that whole piece is, yeah, again, just brought another avenue to the table that is kind of a viable funding route, which is, yeah, again, putting more pressure on funds to really drive that value. You know, I think, as I have said before, ultimately finding investors is like dating. If you want to be with somebody on your cap table for probably at least 5 years, ultimately you best do your work up front to decide whether you're going to enjoy that period of time. So yeah, I think that's what founders do still need to remember. And those that do provide kind of true value over and above capital are the ones that will still be in demand. And I think, you know, that's fantastic for businesses, because you can scale quicker, you can get access to networks that are super valuable, rather than just, you know, having cash in the bank and sending out monthly investor updates. So yeah, it's a really exciting time.
For sure. Actually, one point on the crowdfunding side of things, it's interesting. I edit a newsletter called Angel Notes, which is written by a chap called Manuel. And he kind of scours the crowdfunding sites in the US, the regulated crowdfunding sites, for the kind of most interesting deals. And one that he was looking at recently is valuing at $45 million and doesn't have any current financials. And its last year's financials were $500,000. So there is definitely something kooky in the markets when you're trading at something like 80x multiples, you know, and don't even have current financials to go. So I think, you know, to your earlier point, there's a lot that can still shift. And I agree, that value that you can get out of a great investor that has, you know, the access to the John Lewis's, the Marks and Spencer's, or whoever it may be, as you guys do through the Innovation Hub, or to those PE style businesses that can, you know, that you can draw on the talent or draw on the knowledge from, you know, that's a huge bonus, you know, to businesses that are trying to grow at pace, at scale, and have limited time and limited capital to do that. So Claire, with that all said, thank you so much for joining me. It's been absolutely wonderful having you here today. For our listeners, where's the best place to look for you? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter, elsewhere?
Yeah, LinkedIn is the best place probably, or you can drop me a note through our website, which is true.global. But yeah, feel free to reach out. Always happy to speak to everybody in the ecosystem. So yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Claire, and we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?